I have never tried to teach a whole book of the Bible in 1 hour, and I have no idea exactly how it's going to work. And it worked out well in some respects and not so good in others. I had some thoughts as to what I would have, might have you do some things, and I discovered, I think, that time won't allow certain things to be done here. What I hope to do with the Gospel of Mark really is to give just some pointers, some tools, some handles, some idea of how the Gospel of Mark is structured, and hope that perhaps you might get excited about pursuing a study in the Gospel of Mark on into the future. And the thought occurred to me this morning that I would like to, in a sense, dedicate this 1 hour study to a person. I don't know that a Bible study has ever been dedicated to somebody or not, but books are dedicated to people and buildings and bridges and monuments and what have you. And I think there's probably one other person. I think John, is John Schramm here?
Yeah.
All right, John is here. The person I'd like to dedicate this to is a person that I think John knew. I know John knew. His name is Earl Papke. And he was a teacher of mine when I was a freshman in college, about 19 years old. And some of the ideas that I have to share with you, I think the seeds of them came originally to me from Earl Papke. And Earl had a way of teaching the Bible. It was very, very exciting. And he turned me on. He has just off-the-wall ideas. I remember one time we studied the Old Testament with Earl Papke, and he he asked us to read Ruth and Esther, those two books. And he said, if you can answer any question that I can pose about Ruth and Esther, you'll know the Old Testament pretty well. And I mean, he would go at things like that. And he also had a class on the Gospel of Mark, and that really was the beginning of my love of the Gospel of Mark. So Earl died some years ago, but I just remembered him this morning, and nobody else here knows him except probably John Schramm. Let me just, without putting anyone to embarrassment, how many of you did read the Gospel of Mark in the last couple of days? Amazing. Quite a few of you did. Anybody read it at one sitting? Even more amazing. That's fabulous. It's great. I think very often we don't sit down and read a whole book of the Bible like that, just right straight through, and sort of get the sense of it in the way in which it was written. I think a book like the Gospel of Mark was intended to be read at one sitting. It was intended to be a, you know, right through, here's a story. So I don't know how fast you read, but I guess it could be read in about an hour, and maybe an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours if you're a little bit slower reader. It doesn't really matter, but it doesn't take that long, and you get a whole different picture sometimes of the gospel when you can sit down and read it like that. Each of the four gospels is written differently, you can't mix them up too well. The Gospel of Mark has its own structure and its own methodology, its own way of telling the story. So let me just ask at the beginning here for some impressions. What are your impressions of the Gospel of Mark? What did you have any insights, aha experiences, things that struck you as peculiar, or that kind of thing? What are your reactions? Especially as you get in, as you start out the first part of the book, just listen to this for a second. I'm going to read some of it so that if you didn't get the redundancy of that, this is Revised Standard Version that I'm reading from. In the first chapter, verse 12, or let's go back to verse 10, at the baptism, he came out of the water. Immediately he saw the heavens opened and the Spirit descending as a dove. And then verse 12, the Spirit immediately drove him into the wilderness, and he was tempted there for 40 days and so forth. And then we'll skip over to got to skip a few verses here. Verse 17, Jesus said to these fishermen, follow me, and I will make you to become fishers of men. And immediately they left their nets and followed him. And going on a little farther, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who were in their boat mending the nets. And immediately he called them, and they left their nets and followed him. And verse 21, they went into Capernaum, And immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and taught, and they were astonished at his teaching. And verse 23, and immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean... You get the idea how redundant that word is? And Revised Standard Version is kind of nice because it translates the same Greek word with the same English word every time. Now, some versions will change, give you some synonyms so it doesn't get so boring. But I think that probably Mark could have had synonyms in Greek also. He used that word over and over and over again, redundantly, and it just goes on and on. It just seems like almost at times silly that the word is being used that often. You jump down to verse 29. Immediately he left the synagogue and entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Now Simon's mother-in-law lay sick with a fever, and immediately they told him of... Okay, what is that? Give me a, that's a key thing. So
impatience.
Okay.
Urgency.
I won't write all these words up. It'll take too long. Impatience. Urgency. Why? Why that kind of... That's the tone, isn't it?
So much to do.
Huh?
So much to do.
So much to do. Moving right along here. Okay? Why? I mean, when a writer takes a word like... When a writer starts dumping so much on something like that, there must be a reason for it. I guess what I'm going to try to do in this hour is to some extent, deal with some of the proportions of things in the Gospel of Mark, and the word immediately is used out of proportion to some other words. What is the sense we get of it? Urgency, lots to be done, okay? Just sort of hold that in your head for a second. Any other impressions about the Gospel of Mark? Let me deal with that right now, just sort of get it out of the way. The Gospel of Mark ends... The Gospel of Mark ends, in the Revised Standard Version, it ends in chapter 16, verse 8 says, and they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had come upon them, and they were afraid to, said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. But then the text goes on with more verses. The Jerusalem Bible ends verse 8 by saying, and they said nothing to a soul, for they were afraid. And then there's three dots afterwards, okay? Essentially, what the text in the Greek there ends in a grammatical way which is impossible. It ends with the word for. Syntax can get turned around, I guess, in Greek, and in a sense that sentence ends in an impossible kind of grammatical way. As I understand it, and I could be wrong, there's probably some biblical scholar here who maybe know more, but I believe manuscripts were written on a page of parchment. You wrote a page, and then you wrote the next page, and you sewed the two pages together, and then you wrote the next page, and you sewed that on, and when you got this great big long thing, you rolled it all up on a scroll, and that's how you... Okay, the last page of some of the old editions of Mark's Gospel is missing. That last sewn-on sheet or two was gone, and there were variations that had been added to complete the Gospel of Mark. I think basically it's a technical problem about the ancient manuscript. The most ancient manuscripts, the last page got lost. And there are others who tried to write it to remember it or to add it. All right, good. Moving along, because we're going to have to move pretty fast to cover this in an hour here to get some of the structure out. You could ask the question, what kind of a piece of literature is this? I mean, what kind of a writing is it? And hard to answer that question. Biography? It's not really a biography. How does the Gospel of Mark begin? The beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Now, we just got the question up here, who is this? And the first verse, you get an answer to the question. Whose answer is it? Mark's answer. So Mark lays the answer to the question right out at the very first verse. But as you read the Gospel of Mark, I think you're struck by the constant, that question being posed in some way or another. And what are the answers that are given? And just anybody that happens to come up with an answer. What answers do you find in the Gospel of Mark?
Son of God.
Son of God, okay. Another one. Okay, I'm not sure what verse I'm thinking in terms of.
Verse 2.
Okay, verse 2. Okay, that fulfillment in verse 2. Well, one thing you could do, these are just some pointers, okay? In the weeks and months ahead, if you really want to dig into Mark's Gospel deeper, you might go through the Gospel of Mark, for example, and maybe underline all the answers that you can find to the question, who is this? And you will underline things like rabbi, teacher, one, and you have to, sometimes there'll be expressions like phrases. You won't find one word. Like one answer is one who is in cahoots with the devil. I mean, at one point he was said he is casting out demons by Beelzebul. He's got the devil in him. So one answer is he's the devil or in cahoots with the devil. Any other answers that you might think of?
From Nazareth, they define the location.
Man from Nazareth. Okay, so that's a really...
authority.
He has authority, okay, so that answer to the question would be one who has authority of some kind. And to do that and to really have some fun doing it would be to make parallel columns and, you know, who is this? What is the answer given? And by whom? Who gives the answer? And then verse 1:1... You would say, Son of God, and Mark would be the answer. In verse 1, the answer is so-and-so, and given by this one. You could go through the whole Gospel of Mark, for example, make a trip through it, working with that one question. It would be very instructive. That's a pointer. I mean, it just points you in a direction of something that you might want to do to study the Gospel of Mark. Let me shift the question a little bit here to get at something else. Get at geography. This is the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, the Dead Sea. Okay, that's basically the geography of Palestine. Where is the action as you read it? In other words, you could go through the Gospel now and just look for places. And if you don't know where those places are, get yourself a little map and start spotting them on the map. And what do you come up with? Does anyone?
The River Jordan, the Sea of Galilee, both of those I mentioned earlier.
Okay. The baptism in the River Jordan. Anybody know where Capernaum is?
The North Sea.
Okay, Capernaum is up here somewhere. Galilee, this is Galilee, all right. Around there, Galilee. Where else is Jesus?
He went across the lake, and I don't know where that is. To the Gentile side of the lake.
Okay. Let me just sort of answer the question, because it would take a while for you to go through here and just really find out the places where Jesus is at. Galilee, the whole bloomin' first half of the Gospel, practically, more than first half of the Gospel, is all the action is in Galilee. He only leaves Galilee once, and that's just briefly in the 7th chapter, I think. It mentions that he goes to Tyre and Sidon, and Tyre and Sidon are up here somewhere, north of Galilee. Now, Jerusalem is down here. So the action is all taking place up around Galilee. Now, that's quite different from the other Gospels, because the other Gospels, if you read them, you'll find Jesus kind of bounces up and down between north and south. He goes to Jerusalem, you know, in John's Gospel, very early in John's Gospel, he's at Jerusalem pitching the money changers out of the temple and so forth. But Mark's giving us a whole other picture of the geography and where the action happens. very, very different.
What you're saying is that's the trade routes and the crossroads for everything, right?
I'm not drawing any conclusions from it yet. I'm just saying, see, I mean, just see where Jesus is, geographically, where the action is taking place. Because it is different from the other Gospels, and I think that Mark is, well, as Phil said, the essentials. Mark has pulled out a whole lot of unessential things and got it down to... And one reason that Mark's Gospel, I think, for me, is a good one to study and to get rooted in early, you know, first, is it's fairly simple. It's very uncomplicated to follow. It just moves along in a very, very simple way. And part of that's the location or the geography of the thing. Okay. Let me ask another question that might have to do with proportionality. Keep that map in your mind. There's a card I saw in the store here that says, different living is not living in different places, but having in your mind a map. Having in your mind this map. Give me some words that you would use to describe Jesus here, based just on the reading of the Gospel of Mark. Okay, let me just try to couple things together here. Let's go back to that word immediately for a second. That gives you the impression of action. I mean, you got action moving right along here. You got Mark, who is in a sense an artist, who is drawing some very rapid sketches for you. And he's standing up and he's saying, okay, folks, let me just draw this little sketch. What does that do to you? Put that one aside. Let me draw this little sketch here. What does that do? Put that one aside. Let me do the next one. In other words, you almost got the impression of a motion picture as opposed to still pictures. I mean, it's moving right along. Why? For what reason do you think, who would be interested in that kind of story? Let's go back and check out how the gospel begins. Where is the Christmas story? No, I mean in Mark's gospel.
There ain't one. People already know Jesus' story.
There's no, you know, Dan had the Bible study a few last week or whatever before Christmas, and he said Matthew, the first couple of chapters of Matthew, the genealogy is one of the most exciting chapters in the Bible. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of... And then you can just sort of say, yes, okay. I really got excited about that genealogy thing when Dan did it because of the stuff that he pointed out that was in there. But by and large, you know, if you were just to be, say, what is one of my most exciting chapters of the Bible, it wouldn't be Matthew 1. We ain't that kind of folks. Why ain't we that kind of folks? By and large, Americans don't really care who your daddy and your granddaddy was, right? If you go applying for a job, they don't say, give me your genealogy back 5 generations. I want to know who your great-great-great-great-grandfather was. We just don't care about those things. No one even asks about that in our culture. We are interested in what can the guy do? What can the woman do? Don't tell me about his ancestry. Mark is writing his gospel, I think, for that kind of a people. And I have a sense that that kind of a people in Mark's day were the Romans. They're not the Jews. The Jewish audience was interested in that Jesus was a descendant of David or Abraham. And I think that we Americans are a lot like that. And maybe for that reason, the Gospel of Mark could appeal to us. Let me give you a word that I think might apply to this Jesus as Mark describes him. Try out this word. Controversial. Would that word seem to fit?
Sure.
Is that a fair word? What you're getting a picture of in the Gospel of Mark is a Jesus who is very controversial. again, being reduced to the essence, there isn't much shades of anything in between. Jesus elicits strong feelings, either positive or negative. He's got friends, he's got enemies, and there's hardly anybody in between. Or I don't think there is anybody in between. There are those who either think he's the devil or those who think he's the Son of God. It's just about that stark, a very, very strong, very strongly controversial person. I'm trying to think of somebody today who would be that kind of a controversial person. There are some around, I suppose.
John the Baptist.
John the Baptist was? Somebody today. I'm trying to think of someone today who would just... Okay, Jerry Falwell could be that kind of a person. Jane Fonda, maybe. Maybe Dan Berrigan. I said people have had to respond to him in one way or another. While we're on the subject of friends and enemies, you notice in Mark, as you read Mark's Gospel... you could go through this gospel again and you could just sort of check, underline or something, all the enemies of Jesus and all the friends of Jesus and sort of get some idea of where there are lots of friends and where there are lots of enemies. And why don't we just take a second off the top of your head, see if you can, all of these things, I think, kind of add up to a controversial person. But if you look at the Gospel of Mark, and this is chapter 1, and this is chapter 16 down here, where is the popularity of Jesus? Where would you say the popularity of Jesus reached its peak, if popularity means lots of folks?
With the masses, with the people, with the healing and the talking to them.
When he was teaching it on the lake.
Okay. His popularity, I think, begins to rise right at the beginning.
Towards the end of the first chapter, you can't even go back into the towns.
Popularity is pretty high. I mean, I'm just going to kind of fake this because I can't put it out, all out in detail. But I would say the popularity has to reach a very high peak, the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000. I mean, in terms of how many people you got, if you're popular, if that's the criteria for being popular is that you've got a lot of people around you. You got 5,000 people in his congregation one Sunday morning, and then another, not very much later, 4,000. But that popularity begins to dwindle. And finally, it gets down to just about zilch. And you also could also plot his enemies. Now, opposition to Jesus occurs first, I think, in chapter 2. And the opposition is probably fairly low when he's feeding 5,000, but the opposition begins to climb until the end he's got a lot of enemies, okay? Just sort of hold that in your head for a second. Okay, he's teaching his disciples, and if you read the gospel carefully and sort of watch the action and so forth, there is a very special relationship to the disciples. I only could give a couple of examples here because we wouldn't have the time to flesh them all out. But notice how he teaches in the fourth chapter. That's about where most of the teaching in Mark's gospel is. Matthew's gospel has big chunks of teaching, whole big sections. The Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5, 6, 7, just all solid teaching. You don't run into proportionally that much teaching in Mark's gospel. Again, he's a man of action. He's being portrayed as one who acts. But in the fourth chapter where he's teaching and he's using parables, notice how he pulls the disciples aside and explains privately to them the meaning of the teaching. And as you go through the gospel, and if you would read it and just in the back of your head have the relationship of Jesus to his disciples. For example, look in chapter 9, verse 30. That's probably one of the clearest examples of this. Or even going back to to verse 27. Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately. Okay, there is that private relationship between the disciples and Jesus. Why they could not cast him out. And then in verse 30 it says, they went on from there and passed through Galilee, and he would not have anyone know it because he was teaching his disciples. So we have a picture as you walk through the Gospel of Mark of Jesus in a very important, tight relationship with these 12 people. He is training them. And although he's teaching the crowds, he is investing a great deal of his time in training the 12 disciples. I had a fantasy that we could do this, and I found out that time would not allow it. But I really had a fantasy that I might have you break up into two groups and go through, and we could get a total count of the number of times certain words are used. I figured we could do this in about 8 minutes, but I don't know that I want to invest 8 minutes to do it now. But let me just call your attention to it. Words like understand, or understanding, or know, or knowledge, or perceive. What other words? What are some other synonyms of those kind of words?
I think believe.
Believe.
Okay, now believe is totally different, and that's the other word I want to use here. Believe, or believing, or faith, or belief, or trust, if that word is in there, or faithful, or faithfulness, if that word is in there. Okay. Just your general impression. If you had to bunch these words, just from your general impression, to where they might occur mostly in the Gospel of Mark, does anyone have an impression where they might occur more frequently? That's a dumb question. That's really a vague question. Let me just tell you what I'm getting at. If you were to go through the Gospel of Mark, and I've done this, and you were to keep to what is that thing? If you were to go through the Gospel of Mark and make a tabulation by chapter and make a mark, you know, like in chapter 1, how many times do we have a word know, believe, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, and you do the same thing for these words over here, you know what you'd find? I can't give you the exact numbers of totals, but you would find a very peculiar thing. These words occur in great abundance in about the first half of the Gospel. And these words occur in great abundance in the second half of the Gospel. And it's fairly striking, and if you do that, it's striking enough to me that I say, aha, there must have been a reason for that. It's not just an accident that occurs that way. In this short gospel, the shortest of the gospels, he records two large feedings of people, right? Now, that's peculiar in itself, I think. But in chapter 6, there's the feeding of the 5,000, right? Go on in chapter 7 for a while. He takes a little diversion and goes out of the country and goes up to Tyre and Sidon. And then in chapter 8, again, he's got a large crowd of people and he feeds them with a very small amount of provisions. And then let's take a look at chapter 8, verse 14 and following. I don't know if I should... I think I'll read this again out of the Revised Standard Version. Just listen to this for a second. They get into a boat, verse 13, to cross the lake, And now they had forgotten to bring bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat. And now Jesus again begins to teach his disciples. He cautioned them, saying, "Take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." And they discussed among one another, saying, "We have no bread." And being aware of it, Jesus said to them, "Why do you discuss the fact that you have no bread? Do you not perceive, do you not yet perceive or understand?" See the words? To know, to perceive, to understand. "Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up?" And they said to him, 12. "And the 7 for the 4,000, how many baskets full did you take up?" And they said, 7. And he said to them, "Do you not yet understand?" Okay, I guess I read that fairly blandly. Let me see if I can read it with a little bit more zest than that. And that set the scene. Put yourself in the boat as a disciple, or put yourself in the boat as Jesus. I don't care who you are in the boat, just so that you're in the boat. He has fed 5,000 people with this small provisions. A little bit later, he has fed 4,000 people with this small provisions. And he gets into the boat with his 12 disciples. They set out from shore, and the disciples are worried because there's only one loaf of bread in the boat. Now that's got to really grab you. I mean, and so it grabs Jesus, and I thought when someone said that Jesus was patient was one of the things that was a comment. Here I think we have a picture of Jesus as very impatient. He says to his disciples, "Why do you discuss the fact we don't have any bread? Don't you get it, you dummies? Look at it. We fed 5,000 people. And how many loaves, on 5 loaves, so we said 5,000 people, and then how many baskets full were left over when we were done? All together now, class, tell me, 12. Aha, you got it. Okay, and now we fed 4,000 people. We only had a couple of little bitty fish here and one loaf of bread. And how many baskets were left over? All together now, class, 7. Don't you get it yet? I mean, that's Jesus just frustrated, pulling his hair out and saying, "Good grief, you guys. I've been working with you here for 2.5 years and you haven't got it yet." So he was probably pretty patient up to that point. But in that boat, I mean, you got Jesus who was pretty impatient. Now, I just used the expression 2.5 years. And if you take a look at the Gospel of Mark, if you assume that Jesus' ministry took 3 years, and this is the 16 chapters from 1 down to 16, and Jesus is physically in Galilee. How much time he got left here? 15 minutes, 12 minutes. Jesus is in Galilee the whole time until he goes to Jerusalem. When he goes to Jerusalem, it's the last trip. I mean, he only goes there once. When does he go to Jerusalem? Anybody know just off the top of your head? Chapter? What chapter does he take off? Okay, right around 9 or 10. I think around 10. This is on chapter 8 there. Okay, around chapter 10, he leaves Galilee, he crosses the Jordan. Remember the little map? He goes to the eastern side, the far side of the Jordan, heading right down to Jerusalem, and that's in chapter 10. What triggers this off, do you suppose? What's he going there for?
To die.
When's the first time you heard about that? In chapter 8, okay? The first time you heard about it was in chapter 8. In other words, you got halfway through the Gospel of Mark, no mention yet of any crucifixion, no mention of the passion. All of a sudden in chapter 8, in verse 34, whoops, wait a second, even back before that, in verse 31, it says, "And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly." Now that's the first time he's mentioned that to his disciples. And why do you think he mentions it now? Why do you think Jesus thinks it's time now to prepare them?
He doesn't think they understand it.
They're pretty dense.
Huh?
They're pretty dense.
Okay, they're pretty dense. You're right. Has anything happened that has reduced their density to some degree in the text up to this?
Well, Peter just said that he was.
Okay. For the first time, somebody says, "You are the Messiah." Up to this time, the answer to the question, who is this, could be rabbi, teacher, guru, or whatever. But now Jesus poses the question directly to his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Peter says, "You are Mashiach, you are Messiah. You are the Messiah." And that is precisely when he begins right then to say, "All right, folks, you got it? Understand? Now here's what it means. We're going to Jerusalem. Here we go." It's just like that. So really, here is a gospel. It's got 16 chapters in it. Jesus' ministry took 3 years. In chapter 8, and I'll just put PC here to save time. Peter's confession is right just about in the middle of the gospel. This right here would be about 2.5 years, and let's guess that maybe 5 months or something in here, I don't know just how much. But beginning, and then chapter 11 is the triumphal entry, right? Jesus' entry into Jerusalem. That much of the gospel of Mark, well, I'm putting the dump and making it backwards, is 1 week. Okay? Now if you apply some kind of idea of proportionality to it, that's got to be one important week. You're going to write a book that's that short and you're going to spend cover 3 years of a guy's life and give half of the book to the last week of his life. So it's pretty important. Okay, so he, right after Peter's confession, Jesus begins to teach his disciples now, this is what it means to be the Messiah. We're going to Jerusalem, the Son of Man must suffer and die and so forth. And what happens then? Peter says, Lord, you ain't going to do that. That's not what the Messiah is all about. And what does Jesus say? Get thee behind me, Satan. You don't understand. You're thinking like human being, not the way God thinks. The next big event is the Transfiguration, isn't it? Right. Notice what happens. They go up, you know the story of the Transfiguration. He takes Peter and James and John up there, but the voice that is heard, what does the voice say?
Listen
to him. Okay? You heard those words at the baptism of Jesus, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased," right? Now it says, "This is my beloved Son, listen to him." I mean, it's a reassurance for the disciples, I think, at this point, that what Jesus has in mind is in fact, what the Messiahship is all about. I think a key thing in the Gospel of Mark, I maybe just have to make a quick summary here. One of the key things in Mark's Gospel is that teaching of the disciples. That is kind of the way Mark has written the story. It's the thread that holds it all together. The training of the disciples and the special attention which is given to them, and to helping them understand what it is, what the kingdom of God is, what it is, what the Messiahship of Jesus is all about. There are, I think, 3 times where Jesus describes what the Messiahship is about. The one we just saw following Peter's confession in chapter 9, verses 30 to 32 is another one. Again, now let's just take a look at those. The second, he went there, he passed, he would not have anyone know that he was with the disciples, for he is teaching them, saying, "The Son of Man will be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will, and after 3 days he will rise." But they did not understand the saying, and they were afraid to ask him. And then in chapter 10, verse 32, they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. I mean, this has got, the action is very tense. I mean, they're going to Jerusalem under, I mean, they all know that this is going to be a terrible thing going to happen here. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was going to happen. "Behold, we're going to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be delivered into the chief priests and the scribes. They will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles and mock him," and so forth. And notice, maybe I'll just continue with this one little section because it gets me to someplace I want to go. He tells them about what's going to happen to him and what it is to be the Messiah. And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came forward to him and said, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do?" And they said to him, "Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." Can you get the feeling of that?
Must have been a low place then.
I mean, here is Jesus now is redundantly beginning to teach his disciples what it means to be the Messiah and what it is, and also what it means to be a disciple. I mean, he lifts, you know, transposes it. "If anyone would be my disciple, he must deny himself and take up a cross and follow me." He tells that to the disciples right after Peter's confession. They're on their way to Jerusalem. There's fear, tension, worry, amazement, all these things happening. He tells them again about what this means. James and John come up and say, "Hey, Master, when his glorious kingdom comes, man, we'd like to be, you know, we'd like to be the Secretary of State and, you know, whatever." And so Jesus says, "You don't know what you're talking about. You don't know what you're asking. You know, you want to be really in this kingdom? You want to really be in it? Can you drink the cup I drink? Be baptized with this baptism?" They said, "Sure, yeah, we can do that. No problem, Lord." And he said, "All right, you will drink the cup that I drink and the baptism with which I am baptized. Not up to me, though, to grant who sits on my right hand and who on my left." And as would happen, I think, in any community that's very tightly knit, and this is a tightly knit community of 12 now, the other 10 hear about James and John, and they are indignant. Terrible, terrible thing. And so then Jesus says to them, "You know that those who are supposed to rule over you, over the Gentiles, lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. For whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." I think that, at least I'll give this out as my sense of the Gospel of Mark, the pivot on which the Gospel of Mark turns, in a sense, is Peter's confession. It comes right smack in the middle, and everything up to that point is trying to help the disciples understand something about the kingdom and to come to some awareness of the secret, who this really is. And it shows, as somebody pointed out, healings, casting out demons, various kinds of miracles of that sort. As soon as there is some understanding, we're dealing now with the Messiah, the second half of the gospel acts out what it means to be the Messiah. And it pivots around Peter's confession in a way. But I think the key verse for me in the Gospel of Mark is this one in chapter 10, verse 45. For the Son of Man came also not to be served, but to serve. That's what it means to be a Messiah, and to give his life. And really the whole structure of the Gospel of Mark also fleshes out that one key verse. The chapter 10, verse 45, I think is the whole gospel in a nutshell. This first half is demonstrations of Jesus serving and giving his life, is the second half. There's two key questions, I guess, that I'd like to have sort of be left with. The one is the question that's posed in the gospel, who is Jesus? And you got Mark's answer right in the beginning. You've got various answers of various people throughout the gospel. Near the end, the centurion standing at the cross says, "Sure, truly this was the Son of God." But in a sense, the gospel comes to us and says, what do you say? What's your answer? Who is this? And however you answer the question, the other question I think that comes is, what does it mean to be a friend of Jesus? Because that's a motif that runs through the Gospel of Mark. Friends, enemies. What does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus? What does it mean to be his friend? And I guess all I can say is we got to put ourselves in the boat with him to answer that question. You can't, I guess, be a friend of Jesus without taking up a cross and following him. The only way you'll find out, I guess, I talked with one of the people from the staff after we did this Bible study with the staff earlier, and this is not a verse that's in the Gospel of Mark. I think it's in the Gospel of John, but it's kind of a neat one. People came up and questioned Jesus' authority, and by what authority? Where do you get this doctrine? How do we know it's from God? And Jesus' answer to them was, if you want to know whether the doctrine is true or not, try it out. And that's the only way to find out. Experiment with it. You can't sit down and reason it out. If anyone would know whether the teaching is of God, let him try it out. And he'll find out whether it's from God or not. I think it's quite interesting to me that Gandhi entitled his autobiography, "The Story of My Experiments with Truth." In other words, I think Gandhi took perhaps really the teaching of Jesus and experimented with it, much like a scientist would experiment with things in a laboratory. Not memorized it, he experimented, tested out and see whether it's true or not. And I think that's what we're invited to do with the Gospel of Mark. There's no way for us to know whether, if we lose our life, we'll really find it. The only way to know that is to lose it. Check it out and see whether it's in fact true or not. The kingdom of God, the messiahship of Jesus, is in fact that of being a suffering servant, that of the way of the cross. If anyone would be great among you, let him become servant of all. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life. That's what it is, folks. That's the kingdom of God. Now, if you want to know whether that's true or not, write your own story of your experiments with the truth and see whether that's really true or not. I stop. Oh, boy, I better stop. It's past. Anyway, it's been fun trying to get through one gospel in 1 hour.